All right, everybody. So we have back on the podcast, Dr. Mike Israetel. How you doing, Mike?
Good. I'm doing well. Thank you for having me on, Dave.
Sure. So I am still starting all these with a charity donation. I think last time we did the Giant Octopus Foundation. Are we still sticking with that?
Well, yeah. Giant Octopus Foundation is a for-profit company. It does not receive charity exemption.
I was going to say, I think you might need to be an accredited investor for that one. So,
yeah.
So we will be donating to Operation Smile. I'll be putting a link down below for everybody who, if you're interested in that. So Mike, you're Russian, right?
Yeah.
Are you heard about this Hasbulla kid? Are you aware of this like social media phenomenon? No. Okay. I'll just,
What is it?
It's some kid that I've seen blow up. He's actually 18. He looks like a child. Like he's like 6 years old or something. And so he's got all these videos of him like fighting things and
oh whatever. That kid, yeah, he's like the with Habib and those people.
Yeah, exactly. Yep. So I, yeah. I just saw him in the last couple of weeks. I actually thought he was Habib's child until recently.
Yeah, it's like an adult with some sort of disorder.
So. Yeah. So I'm just curious. Trippy. So you know, one of the reasons, I mean, I've obviously seen plenty of your videos. I'm familiar with your work. One of the other reasons I wanted to get you on is because I did recently start working with Steve Hall of Revive Stronger. And, you know, I've had a lot of people on who follow that camp, you know, all the volume landmarks and everything that you guys talk about a lot. And those are inherently, I think, true principles, right? There's obviously this minimum effective volume. There's obviously a maximum recoverable volume. But I think some people just say, well, you know, we'll just leave it at a certain level. And there was the discussion that you had with Menno recently. So some people were surprised when I went with Steve because that seemed to be, I didn't necessarily follow those methods. And to me, it was kind of like, well, that's exactly why I want to do it. You know, I've been lifting for 16 plus years and I've tried everything under the sun, other than I would say kind of this more auto-regulatory approach of, okay, I'm assessing how is my pump and disruption and readiness and things like that. And so, you know, as somebody who's not going down the performance enhancing drug route and has been lifting this long, I don't know how much I can see, but maybe, you know, with enough placebo effect, you know, you can see what happens. I just want to get your perspective on people who have been lifting for a very long time, who maybe switch over to some of those methods. Have you seen tangible changes or maybe it's more of like a psychological change of how they approach their workouts? I mean, how your experiences with those type of people?
Yeah, I've seen quite notable changes in folks that have really been screwing up. But sometimes you can not really understand the volume landmarks formally. You can even understand them intuitively, or even not even intuitively, but you just happen to land between them. So you're probably pretty good. So like if someone, for example, has a minimum effective volume of 6 sets per muscle per week, the maximum recoverable of 18, and they've just been on average training around 12 plus or minus for a long time, they're going to get great gains like that. And minute changes to how they cycle between those two extremes are going to lead to very minute results that won't be super noticeable. But sometimes based on this very limited or no autoregulation that people do, their MEV, MRV will still be 6 and 18 respectively. But like, you know, they'll for months or years, often years, you know, train at something like 5 to 7 sets per week, or sometimes train at 17 to 19 sets per week or even higher. And then that much training close to minimum effective volume, whether or not you're advanced or drug-free or whatever, and you're trying to train to get as few gains as possible, sometimes you get even no gains, yeah. Sometimes just a bit. And then if you take a person's volume like that and you start ramping it up because maybe they don't know where their MRV is, and it turns out their MRV is around 18 on average, once you get them into the 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13 set per week range, they can get very notable gains and have, under my watch, received such gains. Or if they're always cranking it near MRV, you know, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20 sometimes, overreaching a lot, strength hasn't come up, they feel like super tired, they don't feel a great mind-muscle connection, and then you bring their number of sets down substantially, close to maybe under 10, and then you increase the quality of the training, which is super paramount. You know, are you doing the technique very well? Are you getting a mind-muscle connection? How are your pumps? How is the tension throughput through the muscle? Like, are you... There's a lot of people who do high volume programs. They just kind of do sets, you know, and It's like, well, how much are you getting out of each one of those sets of like pack deck? Well, yeah, I'm trying. Oh, that's nice. So why don't you do two or three sets instead of five or six and really try? And then all of a sudden they're getting great contractions, great tension, tons of progression, and they're doing really well. And then by dropping their volume substantially, their training becomes more consistent and they get great results. I've seen a lot of that happen for sure, because a lot of times people who are more advanced and drug-free, I think a lot of us seem to think that more is usually the answer. And that might not be wrong, but when more is not the answer, we could have been in a situation where we're doing either way too much or a little bit too much for optimum results for a long time. And it's tough to back away, you know, and she'll think, oh, 15 sets per muscle group for my quads per week, you know, it really seems to do the trick for me. And I feel like anything else is too little. And you've maybe even years since you've tried to do around 10. And maybe if you try to do around 10, you're like, oh my God, my recovery is incredible. And the quality of my session is incredible. All of a sudden I'm accumulating for 6 weeks instead of four. And I'm hitting, like, you know, after 2 months, they're hitting PRs and PRs and PRs and PRs. And they're like, okay, my legs are bigger. That's crazy. And it's because I've just been tiring my legs out way too damn much for this long. So very, very short answer for that is, for the people that have been already doing really well with the volume landmarks, even if they're not counting them, you're not going to see big changes. You can't. There's already in that happy middle. But for people that have been at the extremes or even beyond them, training way too little or way too much and sort of for granted, assuming like, oh, yeah, this is how I should train, and never really questioning it when you introduce them to volume landmarks, especially as they're autoregulatorily defined, like, oh, yeah, are you getting pumps? Are you getting soreness? Are you getting tired in the muscle? Like, you know, quite typical example of someone will train their side delts. Say, yeah, you know, this volume is just, I don't think it's enough. And you say, okay, are your delts getting tired? Like after a delt workout? Like, not really. Well, yeah, you should probably make them really tired. You know, there's the universe in which you make excellent gains without ever tiring out your muscles in a single session. It probably doesn't really exist outside of just sheer luck and tons of drugs or having never trained or something that doesn't apply to the situation. And all of a sudden they train their muscles, they train harder, or they train with more sets such that they're really frying out their muscles pretty well at the end of a workout. And all of a sudden, okay, they are making better gains. So that out of regulation tied with volume landmarks can be a good way to see if you're shooting on target. And if you've been shooting on target anyway, sweet. You won't, good news, you've already been doing well. Bad news, you probably can't get that much better. Right. But on the other hand, you may find out, maybe not for all the muscles of your body, but at least some of them, that you haven't been doing so well, and actually you could do better, and you should be doing better. And all of a sudden, when you start doing it, you're like, oh, holy crap, like this is really awesome. And the first thing you'll notice is an improvement in the quality of your training. The second thing you'll notice, like every session feels better, like feels like, oh, wow, I really did something to my chest. It's really that golden zone. The next thing you'll notice is your progressions will be smoother. Like, oh, shit, I've added 5 pounds or a rep to my incline Smith machine bench for like every week for 4 weeks now, 6 weeks. Like, I haven't done that in a long time. I'm hitting all 10 PRs. And then the last thing you'll notice is big PRs, like your exercise abilities are now qualitatively just categorically above what they used to be. And then once you notice those, you'll notice the fourth thing, which is the only thing we actually want, which is you're like, oh, shit, I actually am bigger now. Like, yeah. It had worked.
Well, I think what you talked about in terms of like, okay, like the actual sets will be better and like the focus on them is interesting, because at the end of the day, like a lot of times, you know, I've said this years back and a lot of people will say, okay, well, like who cares about, let's say, pump or how this feels. If you take somebody whose bench press goes from 225 for 10 to 315 for 10, that's going to be a much bigger person. And I agree with that. I mean, in almost all cases, but what I would say is like, well, how do you get there? Right? Because it's one thing to just say that, but that doesn't mean you just go in, you just bench 225 for 10, and then the next week you do 230 for 10, et cetera. So to all of like your points there, it's like, well, these methods in theory will get you the growth, or maybe like to your point, if you feel nothing in that muscle growth or in that muscle group, there won't be the growth to then lead to the strength to then eventually over, you know, however many years, get you to that higher bench press. Because I've seen you say many times over and over, of course, you do want to get stronger over time, but it's like, I think the biggest debate between these different camps is like, how are you getting there? And to your point, if you're not even feeling it, it's probably not doing a ton.
A bunch of classic examples. So let's say that you happen to be a person who's working on getting bigger legs. And for you, the squat exercise is something that when you normally do it in such a way as to lift the most weight, you use a lot of glutes and a lot of your back, which is totally fine in powerlifting, totally fine way to squat, and it's great hypertrophy for your glutes and back. You don't really feel your quads a ton. You never really did. And someone tells you, look, you're like, oh, I'm not feeling it in my quads. Like, am I getting like a quad pump from squatting? Is that a problem? And, you know, this caricature of an individual replies back to you like, dude, it doesn't matter. Just get stronger and your muscles are growing. Right on. So I do the squat for months and months and months. And because the weights are going up and because I'm really feeding to my strengths, which is an important point, what are my strengths? Well, super strong back, super strong glutes that always try to engage. My technique even changes slightly over the course of these few months to result in more glute and lower back engagement and less quad engagement fractionally because, I would be playing to my weaknesses. Why would I do that? So after 6 months, your squat has gone up substantially and you come back to the gym or you're in the gym again and that guy is there and he's like, hey, you see, you're squatting a lot more, buddy. How are your quads? And you could honestly be like, I don't think my quads have gotten any bigger. My back's doing cool shit. So my glutes. So it's one of those like, that's a problem. And it even applies to isolation exercises. A lot of the strength you gain is neural. It's technical. It's architectural. So you could say, okay, my ability to, do bicep curls with a cable or tricep extensions or something has over the past several months substantially improved. I really feel like I'm trying hard on the exercise and I'm getting these old PRs. But at the same time, like I don't really get big pumps, big soreness, my muscle doesn't feel tired. And it's just my elbows hurt, my shoulders are hurting a little bit towards the end of the sets. I'm getting stronger, but my joints are starting to hurt. And then you look at it honestly, you go, my triceps don't really look that much bigger. I'm just using the same triceps that I had to get them stronger, and I haven't optimized for size. And one way in which that reflects itself with the stimulus to fatigue ratio is maybe your rep range is wrong. And there's countless times when people have done a certain exercise they think is not a good exercise. They did it in a rep range in which it's not optimized. People do tricep extensions with sets of 5 to 10. They get no pump, nothing. They get some tension, but it just ends up hurting their joints. They're like, I'm getting stronger, but I don't know if this is like making me as jacked as possible. And then at the other end, they try a sets of 20 to 25 at some point because they're tired of their elbows hurting. And after 3 sets, they're blown up like crazy. You can barely move the triceps. Triceps are so tired, they can barely contract. And then 3 days after, they're sore. And then they keep repeating that because they're like, I feel like it's doing something. I'm just not going to discount this. And then they have bigger triceps weeks and months later. So the idea that you just have to chase strength PRs is true as far as it goes. It helps to train for strength, or it helps to notice your strength and where it's going. But it doesn't mean you issue every single other factor completely out of the equation. It's like if you're, taking a road trip to another city that's 4 hours away, the only thing you actually need is an engine with some kind of control mechanism on it. Like you can sit on an engine with wheels and a fucking steering wheel and technically get to New York City from Philadelphia. You can do it. So if someone's like, hey, what kind of car should I rent to go to New York or to go to Philly? Someone's like, it doesn't matter. Just make sure it has a fucking steering column, wheels, and an engine. And you're just like, oh, right on, man. Yeah, I know how transportation works. Thanks so much. But maybe I'd like to be a modicum of comfort. Maybe something I'm interested in, or the weather not getting in my face, and 50 other things that optimize the process to get what we really want, which is a pleasant road trip. So another thing that people go too far with the strength stuff is there's a conundrum that ends up occurring where they're like, you can ask them to say, if strength on the compound movements is really all we're interested in, mind-muscle connection, all that stuff doesn't matter, pump doesn't matter, should we expect that if we trained exactly like powerlifters, we would get the maximum hypertrophy results? And they would say yes. And they often say yes, even on podcasts, these folks. And it's just wrong because powerlifters aren't as jacked as bodybuilders. And there's another line of evidence there where when powerlifters switch to bodybuilding, they start training for more mind-muscle connection. They start to try to value pumps a little bit more and soreness and really eking up, all the energy from the muscle they're targeting and really being concerned about, is this exercise targeting my quads? A lot of powerlifters, when they switch to bodybuilding, will not just squat anymore for their quads. They'll start doing leg extensions and hack squats and leg press. Do you think why? Like, why don't they just get stronger at the squat? Well, they're really strong at the squat and the quads aren't that big. They could be bigger. Mm-hmm. And if we got them bigger, they wouldn't be very functional because they're optimized for size from hack squats and leg presses. And they would carry over to the powerlifting movements. But then, your weight class isn't the right one anymore because you're super jacked. Like, I've actually seen a couple of very high level bodybuilders compete with powerlifters in powerlifting. And you're like, man, that guy looks amazing and he looks so strong. But honestly, he's losing to guys or tying guys that look 20 pounds less muscular than him. They really weigh in 20 pounds lighter. So he's in a weight class way too high. He's got all these billowy, poofy muscles. But if that's what we want, we should probably train like that. And it's a very odd curiosity when you have specifically intermediate or beginner natural bodybuilders, the people that love to say this kind of stuff. And I can get into why they say it, my suspicion. They say, you just got to train like a powerlifter to get huge, except all the biggest powerlifters, when they try to get huge, they train like bodybuilders. Like, they literally switch their training to train like bodybuilders. That's a curiosity we'd have to address. Are they really just that, those powerlifters? that dumb. They're abandoning on what got them huge, and they really should be making no change whatsoever. It's strange the imagination to think. Would you like me to share my ideas as to why
I think folks would love that? Yes.
So, one thing, I think the biggest thing is ego. I think ego expresses itself in two ways here. One, folks need to be able to justify to themselves why they're lifting a certain amount of weight. And it's much easier to justify if that weight is heavier. So when people say, hey, listen, you got to get on this cable curl machine and you got to do sets of 20 and really get the pump and the burn and destroy the muscle a little bit and let it recover, they say, oh man, you know, that's like 50 pounds. I don't want to be seen curling 50 pounds. What the fuck? Like my sister does that. Not that. I want to be lifting serious weight. I'm not big and strong enough yet to do that. But if I do underhand pull-ups, I'll quote unquote nominally hit the biceps, at least on paper. But I can lose like 25 pounds because I'm skinny and I don't weigh much and I can do plenty of pull-ups. And if I do them underhand, I can even do them with a 25 pounder. And then the huge 300 pound guy at the gym kind of nods at me because he's like, damn, I can't even do weight attached underhand pull-ups. And I feel like I'm competent. And the other thing is they'll say things like, well, you know, you got to pick compound movements, but are, this is a classic statement that are it's never this intellectually phrased, that are amenable to being overloaded or that are like ideal to overload, which means like something like bench or squat or deadlift or overhead press, like you can add weight over time. You know, if we think for like 3 seconds about that, we can actually add weight over time to every single exercise that's ever existed, except we have to have very small fractions. And that's where you get back to the ego. Nobody wants to add 2.5 pounds to the curl bar every 2 weeks. But if your biceps are growing at a really good rate, that's what you're going to be adding. Mm-hmm. But they want to add 5 pounds every week. How do you do that if you weigh 140 pounds and you're drug-free and you've lifted for 8 years? You got a bench, squat, deadlift, overhead press. I mean, it's got to be a compound move. If you leg press, gee, you know, you're already leg pressing 400 pounds. You can add 2.5 pounds every week and feel really good about yourself. And even 5 pounds, you know, getting the 2.5s and carrying them across the gym and putting on something, it's almost like a sign of defeat to many people. Like, I should be progressing with big weights, not these 2.5s. So I think a lot of times that basically that two-factor ego thing is, one, I need to be lifting big weights, so I want only compound movements that let me lift a lot. And two, I want the essentially immediate gratification of being able to get stronger every session. And the way you do that is you focus on lifting for strength with compound movements in the 5 to 10 rep range. Ta-da! And that's great for checking the boxes of the ego. And it's just a great overall way to train. If you're interested in optimization for hypertrophy, you're going to have to let your ego down a little bit and do some higher reps, do some isolations, and be ready for the progress to be more slow.
So I just wanted to write down so I don't forget the comments I had on those. So I can attest to the ego thing because that has been something that I've kind of dealt with throughout most of my lifting career. Because frankly, you know, I've discussed before, I was always stronger than I looked. You know, I started at, I mean, I'm 6'1 now, but I started at 5'11, 130 pounds. So even after I
put huge,
even after I put on 50 pounds of muscle, I was now like normal. Right. And yeah, so, and it was always kind of like, this is all I have is my strength, you know, cause I'm not going to impress anybody size wise. So it's like, this is what I have. And, you know, I know we have mutual contacts in Paul Canoe and Joey Zatmary, and I've, you know, worked out with both a couple times. And I recently did 100-pound pull-ups for 6 reps. So it's perfect to your example. And like, that was a
Paul Canoe can't do that.
No, he can't do it. And he's my weight. And then Joey Zatmary definitely can't do it because he's got 100 pounds on me or whatever it is. So but
they're slightly more muscular than you.
Just a little bit more muscular than me. And you know, and Paul is actually pretty strong on pull-ups. Like he was doing controlled reps and everything, but still at the same body weight, that's one of the few exercises I'm stronger than him at. And I will say my back of my muscle groups, my back is a strong point for me, but still it's obviously, there is an ego to it. And that's actually why I discussed with Steve was that, you know, when we do this, it is a purely like whatever you tell me, 100% hypertrophy focus. So we're taking out barbell bench press, we're taking out barbell overhead press, because I know that after doing those for like my entire life, there's just too much ego. Like if I don't have at least, if I'm not repping out 225 at least, I'm like, you know, it's just going to bother me. So let's just take it out and just avoid that. So that's just to attest to your comment on the ego, because it's absolutely a thing.
Yeah. Real quick, an interesting analogy, very close to just what really happens in another field. It's just almost not an analogy, it's ophthalmology, is that people are sort of tacitly admitting when strength is their real forte, and they switch to hypertrophy training, they're tacitly admitting that they're doing something they're not very good at or as good at as they'd like to be. So they're stepping onto a kind of like a shaky foot, which if you think about is the same in almost every situation in which you want to become good at something you're not. Like if I wanted to learn Spanish, I would blow at Spanish for a while. It would be embarrassing. Like Dr. Mike, I can talk circles around damn near anybody. Yeah, I have this verbal IQ of like a trillion, blah, 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 blah. Look at all these amazing words I can turn around the spot. I can't do that in Spanish. I'd be like, me llamo Miguel. I sound like an idiot. But like, that doesn't mean I speak English still and pretend I'm learning Spanish. It'd be like, no, it's good. Just speaking English is great for Spanish development. Like, maybe it's better than nothing. All not right. speaking to anyone. But you know, like if your thing is hypertrophy, and the methods that are seem logically the most increased hypertrophy, you know, some mind-muscle connection, basically an understanding that you're actually using the target muscle. Right? That's what we mean. We don't mean anything fancy, but it's like if you're doing sets of 10 in the squat, and I'm like, hey, your quads getting anything? And you're like, I don't get to be honest, not really. Like, what are we doing here, right? So some of that, some of the higher rep ranges, or at least experimenting with rep ranges that give you the best pumps and soreness and mind-muscle connection, and that feel of tension through the muscle, if you have to do those things and you're not really any good at those things, but these are the things logically that are going to make you the best at hypertrophy, you have to just sit down and say, okay, I'm not good at these things, but I want the results of being good at them. So I have to start trying them. I suck at the Spanish language, but after a 6 months course and a 3 months immersion living in Spain, I'm going to be very fucking good. And then I'm going to be able to talk to people and be like, oh, thank God I put in the work of this annoying stuff. So when you're on stage, you're in your bathroom in front of your mirror 6 months or 12 months later after starting to train more like a physique athlete or someone specializing in hypertrophy, you're going to look at your body and be like, holy crap, I look amazing. Thank God I stopped being an idiot about this stuff. And real quick, another thing, as you get bigger and stronger, especially the chance of injury you have from training for strength and only the compound movements versus the chance of injury you have training through a broad spectrum of rep ranges in compound and isolation movements that I will say are designed to limit how much total force is being produced and instead focus on more force production per one muscle, which means the external load has to fall often. And also you have to control the load. Slower eccentrics aren't really that great for strength because it's just wasting your time, but they're great for hypertrophy. If you start doing those things, then your chance of injury goes down. So for me, one of the biggest changes was I would always train for years and years and years. I built probably most of my size was hardcore sets of 5 to 10, mostly compound exercises, right? Some isolations every now and again, but weighted pull-ups. I've done decent technique pull-ups weighing 260. I've done like 8 or 9 reps with a 25 pound hanging, which is like pretty rare for that body weight. Like that's a lot of pull-up. Yeah, yeah. Super heavy rows. Deadlifts, deficit deadlifts, blah, blah, blah. I did it all. And what I learned was once I got into my early 30s, especially, sometimes I would travel for work and I would have to go to another gym where maybe I didn't have my chalk or I bought my straps, but you know, some bars like without chalk, even the straps don't do shit. Mm. Or I'm really tired from a flight and I'm like, I'm not going to risk my lower back doing this stupid shit. I'll just do more of a bodybuilding style workout, slightly higher reps, sometimes more isolation, more mind muscle connection. And then I realized, Dave, that like those workouts were straight up stimulus to fatigue ratio better than the ones I usually do. And I'm like, well, what if I just train like this all the time? And then looked at a bunch of other bodybuilders do, and they really just train for bodybuilding all the time. And they rarely get hurt. Because how the fuck do you get hurt with like super controlled incline dumbbell press? You don't really, but super heavy barbell bench press, sets of 3 to 5. Yeah, you know, you roll the dice every time. So another cool thing is not only did this result in better hypertrophy results, but it gave me a lower probability of injury, which I'll tell you what, like, especially when you get bigger and stronger, and especially if you're using special sports supplements, it's not something that isn't out of your mind every time you train. I mean, right now, with the ultimate alignment against my own body to be as weak as possible, quote unquote, or to isolate the muscle to a huge extent, I'm hack squatting at least 5 plates on most machines for sets of 10 to 15. That's with all the modifications. If I did the hack squat to produce as much force as possible, I would be doing 7 plates, no problem.
Right.
I've pulled my quad before hack squatting or my adductor. I'm not interested in that shit anymore, man. So any way I can train that optimizes the stimulus but reduces the fatigue and the risk is great. And if that optimization leaves what's optimal for the stimulus, like if I start reducing risk so much, I'm like, all right, it's too risky to do any kind of compound leg moves. I'm just doing isolations, only leg extensions. That'll cost me size as well. But if I can stay with the trade-offs that are still optimized for size, but bring down the risk a little bit, I'll take them. And moving away from super strength only lifting to more hypertrophy focus, slower, more focus on the muscle, whatever rep range results in the best outcomes, pump, burn, et cetera. That is also so much less injurious that, man, it just makes sense on a whole bunch of different grounds.
I think it definitely does make sense. And I would agree. This is something I don't know if you know Brian Borstein, but it's something I've spoken with him about as well. And he's pretty gifted, very impressive physique. And we have we've just laughed because we have almost identical strength on almost everything. He has a much more impressive physique. And I said, I didn't start out thinking I want to be so strong. I was purely physique oriented. And it just happened to be that, I just wasn't that gifted. And even just my actual measurements and everything were fine. Maybe, would equate to somebody else's, but very long arms, very long legs, all these things that just don't look as impressive. So what ended up happening was I absolutely care more about the physique. It's just that it didn't match the impressiveness of my strength. And so I think about that sometimes of you're right. I'm 30 now. I'm not going to want to be doing, 5 rep maxes on bench press and then pull-ups and stuff all the time when I'm 40 plus. But, and this is admittedly purely an ego thing. I'm just kind of speaking to those people like me, where I think it's just a hard thing to accept that, the other day when I was doing those pull-ups, some college kid, I saw him recording me, he just pulled his phone out to record me. And there was a little ego thing, which at 30, I should not care about that. But there was a little ego boost to it.
Yay.
But, yeah, right, right. But the point is that will go away. But I fully agree with all your principles of if you can step back and take the ego out of it, you're 100% right. I absolutely agree that the lighter weight, the ideal form, all of those things are at least as good, probably better for hypertrophy. And it's just stepping back and kind of acknowledging it.
Yeah. Another super, super quick, another way I sort of started to realize that at some point was I would get hurt maybe not in the target muscle, but in a related joint or muscle, I'd have to modify my training to make it more isolation, more focused on my muscle, less moving raw weight, less involving the rest of my body. And I was like, God damn it. Well, I'm not going to get the gains I used to in my chest because, I hurt my back. But, because I can't bench press barbell anymore, the back's too hurt. I'll have to get on a machine. We'll have to use dumbbells, or I'll have to slow the bench press cadence. But I'm really going to fire into the muscle and really try to focus. And I'd have those workouts for 6 weeks as my back was healing. And I was like, dude, I think I just made the best chest progress I have in years. And it's not because the back, I wasn't training it or whatever, because the legs I wasn't training. It was also each session for chest wasn't this kind of oh, shit, I wish I could do something fucking heavy. Damn it. I don't have exactly the feel I want. Each session I left the gym, I was like, that was an amazing workout. It's getting better, better, better. So wait a minute. If I'm only doing these workouts when I'm hurt, but they seem objectively better than the workouts I'm doing when I'm not hurt, am I exactly and there's another quick thing. There's evidence from powerlifting and strongman and tons of other sports where sometimes powerlifters and strongmen will get hurt. We'll take a few months off of going super heavy. And during that time, they're like, fuck it, I might as well train for hypertrophy. They get so fucking jacked. Yeah. They have a total physique transformation. And then you're like, oh, wait a minute. I thought the core of being jacked was to be super strong and lifting your best compound loads. These guys literally moved away from that and got more jacked. How does that work? And the answer is bodybuilding training is a little bit different than strength.
Do you find, you gave the example before of the triceps, doing 5 to 10 reps, and then you get this, you go up in reps, you get this great pump. I would say, almost universally, if you're going from 5 to 10 to 20 plus reps, your pump is going to be greater. But you also discussed trying out different rep ranges. Do you find that you ever have people drop the rep range and due to, muscle fiber type and whatnot, that they get better results that way? Or are you
unequivocally, absolutely. And that's something I don't talk about much in this context, but I will right now, because the population we were talking about does the opposite problem. They're always going too heavy and never light enough. But the other population, although it's smaller, absolutely does exist. You'll have guys who are doing leg extensions and walking lunges, sets of 20 or 30, really great burn, blah, blah, blah. And so, yeah, my training's really good. And I feel like I'm progressing well, but I need something in my leg training. I feel like it's missing. And I'm like, oh, I'll tell you what it's missing, motherfucker. You don't know how to do a high bar squat properly for sets of 5 to 10, really activating your quads, leaning into them. You don't know how to do leg presses or hack squats for sets of 8 to 12. All the shit you're doing is 20 or 30, which is fine and effective. But there's a certain amount of faster twitch fraction of your motor units, especially in huge muscles, powerful muscles of the legs. You're just not really activating as much as you could be unless you're going heavier. And there's no way to find out unless you try. And of course, you eat into it. And I'll get guys, doing hack squats for sets of 8 to 12. And a few sets in, they're like, I have a fatigue in my muscle that's so deep, I don't understand what's going on. Nothing I've done in the last 6 months feels like this. When I get my quad burn on extensions, I get a little surface burn, it hurts a bit, and then it goes away, and then I feel fine. And it's 3 minutes after my set, I'm not breathing heavy anymore. Something in my muscles is wrong in the best way possible. That they're way too pumped. They feel almost rock hard. I feel like I fatigued something deep in there that just wasn't reaching with these super light weights. And that's totally a thing that's experienced a bunch. I have super faster twitch triceps and chest. Mm-hmm. If I do chest, that's for 20 reps plus. I literally just get tired and my pump isn't amazing. I just get tired and flat and flat and tired and flat. And then I leave. And I'm like, that was dumb. It's just like, hey, you want jacked legs? Go run around the block three times. That's not going to get you jacked legs. It's going to get you tired and depleted. And then I switch to sets of more like 10 and 8 with chest. And I'm like, oh my God. And there's another thing. Pump is a factor, but so is tension perception. If you're doing cable flies for sets of 30 and you're doing it here, and someone's like, do you really feel the tension in your pecs? Like, oh, your tension causes hypertrophy. You're like, I don't know, not really, man. I just feel like I'm doing this. You're just moving around. But you know, do you feel tension in your quads when you step on your gas pedal in your car? Probably not. But then when you do a sets of 8 with flies, super controlled, especially at the bottom, someone's like, do you feel the tension? Like, dude, oh my God, my pecs are going to fucking rip apart. I feel every tiny piece of my being in every single contraction. Gee, you know, man, that could be pretty effective. So if you're feeling the tension, some combination of feeling the tension and getting a good pump and getting the muscle very, not completely, but very well exhausted and perturbed. Like if you try to curl, but your biceps cramp up on you, like you did something right. And it could have been whatever different. If you add up all those factors and a few more, the exercise types that get you the most overall, that's probably the ones that are the best. And that means a bunch of different rep ranges can be great. So like kind of, as you said, we may be able to maximize pump in the higher rep ranges, but maximize intramuscular tension perception at the lower ones, which means both are the correct answer. But also, and there may be some different pathways involved, such that when someone's been maximizing tension in the muscle by training for strength for a long time, sets of 5 to 10, they may have never really exploited the pump stuff. And when they start doing it, they get all these crazy new gains just on novelty alone. So some combination is good, which you just don't want people to do. However they combine it strategically or all at the same time, it doesn't matter as much as people who just write off a certain kind of training altogether. They say, well, I'm a person who does compounds for progressive overload, whatever that means to them. That means I do bench and overhead and squat for sets of 5 to 10. Everything else is pump work. And they'll even people make up, literally just make up things like, oh, like higher reps are for people who use drugs. Like, really? They are? The tension no longer stimulates hypertrophy when you get on gear? How does that work? And there's no answers requested, no answers given. It's just an excuse, again, as we talked about, for ego. But then they basically leave out those effective rep ranges or techniques or exercises that when they try them by some stellar alignment coincidence later, they're like, oh man, what the fuck have I been missing? That's what you don't want to do, is dogmatically say, well, this stuff's not for me. At least try it for a mesocycle and be like, wow, actually it is for me. Or if you try it and it sucks, you don't have to do it anymore.
Sure. So, and a couple points there. I think, well, one, I want to talk about the novelty aspect, but also the idea of the resensitization. You know, there's, you talk about it in the context of, okay, over mesocycle, like you ramp up and then you deload. If there's anybody who will be an experiment about resensitization, it's me, because I've mentioned that I, for a long time, I did a lot of different things. And so I think some people who only more recently saw my channel or my stuff think that I'm like a very low volume advocate, and that's like all I recommend. It's really not the case. I mean, I've done as high as 30 sets. I've done a few of John Meadows' programs and specialization programs and all these things like that. And what happened was once I got into about year 12 or so, and I just wasn't noticing much, I said, all right, instead of the yearly bulk and cut, I'm going to do a 2-year bulk. I gained like 40 pounds. I cut back down, netted just about nothing. And I was like, all right, at that point, you know, I'm just going to do some other things with my life, but still work out 3-4 times a week, et cetera. Sure. Which I don't think is an unreasonable approach, you know? So
not at all.
But in the last 2 years, I've rarely done more than, other than back, I've rarely done more than 6 sets per body part per week. And that has not surprisingly maintained everything more or less. But it is quite low relative to, you know, what most people recommend. So I just think it'll be interesting to see, all right, 2 years of basically 6 sets, is resensitization a thing even after you've already hit a point where you don't seem to be making any more progress? You know, I don't know if you have thoughts on that, but
I do. I don't think you need probably in many cases more than 2 months of resensitization.
Right. Yeah.
But if you got 2 years, you're overqualified and you should experience some kind of thing. So basically when Steve starts to gently ramp your volumes or auto-regulatorily ramp your volumes, then you'll probably see some pretty cool gains. And then if you take another 2 months of low volume, you will see another spate of good gains again. But the 2 years, I don't think affords you any more of a rebound. But, you know, 2 months even is a long time for many people who never do back away from volume that long. And then you can get pretty good gains, very likely. New gains, not just regaining the old stuff by backing off for a while and then coming back. I just would caution people as to think, oh man, really going to back off for 6 months. Like anything after 2 months probably is just lost opportunity to continue to grow.
Right. Now that's a good point. And as far as novelty, I've seen you and other people with Renaissance Periodization discuss the idea of novelty. And to me, I always found, and I know other people have said this as well, it's like anytime I add a new exercise, I'm like, well, of course, I'm getting significantly stronger on it because, you know, we talk about these neurological adaptations. But I will say, and I guess if you want to combine this into one, one question I was going to ask is, do you find that the discrepancy between bodybuilders and let's say powerlifters is greater in an enhanced population? And I never want to be the person saying, oh, everything changes when you're enhanced. Like there's obviously a ton of similarities, but when I feel like when we look at the people who are naturals, they seem closer, and that could just be because we see a lot of crossover, right? Like an Eric Helms competes at both, Alberto Nunez competes at both. So maybe that's why, but it does seem like in those cases, there's less of a discrepancy. Whereas when you look at like the really enhanced guys, you're totally right. There are some of these guys who are, you know, the top powerlifters and top bodybuilders, and the strength and the size is vastly different. So I guess that's a part one, but a part two of that is just with the novelty. I really have seen that when I look at the core exercises that are good for certain muscle group, as I've gotten stronger for reps over time, they've gotten bigger. When I add a new exercise, I could progress for months, and as far as I can tell, I'm not getting bigger and I'm just adapting to the exercise. But I know you guys talk about this novelty as being a stimulus for growth quite a bit inherently.
Yeah. So on the first question of does natural bodybuilding and powerlifting have sort of more common training wise and post wise than enhanced? I'd say yes, and maybe 10% of that is the different kind of enhancement between powerlifters and bodybuilders.
Mm-hmm.
I would say that mostly the other explanatory factor is that natural bodybuilders don't have to specialize as much because the competition's not as hard, because the number of people engaged in natural bodybuilding in the U.S., for example, is some tiny fraction of the number engaged in competitive unnatural bodybuilding. So the whole sport of natural bodybuilding isn't as advanced and thus does not require that specific level of integration to see some good results. For example, you know, back baseball, Babe Ruth regularly drank beers during games and he was still the best guy in the league. You really can't get away with that now. Everyone's too damn good. And Babe Ruth wouldn't even make, you know, probably struggle to make an actual protein nowadays. You know, with no insult meant to natural bodybuilders, but it's a small pool, very small pool. And then we can actually, the third factor is we look at who actually wins most of the shows. And it's not the evidence-based guys mostly. It's just bros that have excellent genetics that are drug-free. They're the ones that win most of the stuff. And they train a lot like bros, unfortunately. Very close to like exactly the pro bros that are on drugs. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Doug Miller, I don't know if you've ever seen any of his training. That's one of my favorite observations is to try to just read accounts of naturals trying to make sense of Doug Miller's training. Like, yeah. I noticed that he does X, Y, Z, and that's why his arms are so big. Like, no, his arms are really big because he's Doug Miller. He was destined to have big arms and look like that. And no, as far as being completely frank, I don't find a high level of organization to his training. And I find much of it is just bro stuff, which is fine. Got him really jacked. Could he get more jacked doing evidence-based stuff, training like Eric Helms and Alberto Nunez? Yeah, probably, but he's not. And he's more jacked. So when we say like, oh, somebody should name this fallacy. There's an idea that if you expose to bodybuilding through the evidence-based portal into it, which is not the only portal, You seem to think that the natural bodybuilders who are at the top are, you know, Eric Helmsley, Bernard Nunez, Brian Miner, and those guys. And they're very good. They're not at the top. They'll be the first people. Eric Helmsley will tell you, what, I'm not at the top. Like, I'll make a pro, you know, get a pro card, make a pro show appearance. That's neat. But other guys are winning the shows and they're mostly bros. Now, it doesn't say anything bad about Evan Space community. It's just not true to make the assumption to say, well, you know, naturals seem to be more evidence-based. Like, you're not talking all the naturals. Mm-hmm. There's actually tons of more evidence-based drug bodybuilders now, countless ones, more and more and more of them. And if you got into bodybuilding through, you know, a couple of these, you know, if you got into enhanced bodybuilding through John Jewett, for example, you'd be like, oh, enhanced guys really think things through. Like, well, John Jewett's not the only guy on that stage, and a lot of those guys don't think shit through. So I think it's like there is something to it. Yeah, the training is not as different, but it's pretty similar, and both trainings for drug-free and not tested on the bodybuilding side is pretty fucking bro-y, unfortunately.
Yeah.
For now, anyway.
Yeah, and I agree with all that. I think this is kind of like the last point, but do you think maybe like a fourth point would also be just inherently people gravitate towards what they succeed in and what they're better at, and so if somebody just finds that they have a predisposition towards strength, they're like, well, this bodybuilding thing's going okay, but you could take like a Lane Norton. I mean, he's good at both, but he found that he was good at bodybuilding, but exceptionally good at powerlifting. Sure. And so then of course they're going to train as they think they're supposed to there. So just that predisposition as well.
Sure. And, you know, there's a big difference between, take a look at someone like Jeff Alberts, you know, he's in that whole crew, except he trains almost exactly like a bodybuilder. He's really stimulus to fatigue ratio seems very important to him. He's very meticulous on his exercise and technique. He progresses very slowly through loads, making sure that the technique's never off and X, Y, Z. He doesn't just use conventional exercises. He uses plenty of Smith machine stuff and lots of leg presses and things like that, because he's like 1,000 years old or whatever, and still in the shape of his life. And he knows he can't afford to go through crazy strength phases because it's going to break him into pieces. So yeah, like the other thing exists too, where you have intelligent drug-free bodybuilders that are training in that kind of bodybuilding-esque way, still with progression, of course, but in all that checking the boxes and not just trying to be like an amateur powerlifter or something like that.
Right. For sure. For sure. I want to talk a little bit about one's preferences towards training here, because that's, you know, we talk about what's effective, but there's also a preference. And one of the things that I said with working with Steve, as I said, like, you know, to, when I had like a video out on it, I said, even if nothing happens, like we work together for 6 months and there's no net benefit, like to me, after lifting for so long, you try to find ways to find it enjoyable and, you know, to get excited. And I will say, like, already that's happening where I'm excited, you know, I'm lifting right after the podcast and I'm excited to go do it, to do something that's different. He sends me like a weekly check-in and I'm excited to open that email. So I think that is already, you know, a psychological benefit to it. And I want to touch on that, but I also want to discuss placebo because, you know, you're obviously very familiar with the steroid studies and like, you know, just the massive improvements. And I think there was one that was longer term and then one that was acute, right? Like they told them they were taking, it might've been Dianabol and they had this incredible strength gain. So I want to share a story with you that I've told on podcast once before. I'm sure you haven't heard it. So years back, my brother is older, but he got into lifting way later than me. And he, you know, considered me very knowledgeable and somebody he could trust in the subject. So he was about 2 years in, I want to say, and we have a home gym. And so his best bench press was, I believe at the time it was like 185 for 8. And he would really push. I mean, he was like, that was like, you know, zero RIR. And because I see these studies and they just seem unbelievable to me, I'm like, all right, like I want to test this out. So,
oh boy, poor brother's getting an experiment.
Right. So I gave him a pre-workout beta alanine. And because you can feel it. So I figured, okay, he's going to believe it because he can feel it. And why he took my recommendation to do this, I don't know. But I told him it was a very fast acting steroid. And I said, like, you know, I was like, it's not going to do too much harm to you. It's just, you're going to be really strong. Like seriously, like it acts quickly, all this stuff, you know, hype him up. So we go into the basement, we warm up everything. We put on 185. I said, all right, go as hard as you can. And he got again, 8 reps. So no difference whatsoever. And I was actually surprised to see no difference. But I question these studies, and I know, I think they might've been replicated once, but I tell the story because I just think it's interesting how we talk about how impactful placebo effect is. But that was just one, you know, counterexample. But I don't know. Do you have a hard time believing those studies that are just so incredible?
I don't have a hard time believing them, but because I've done research before and I know who the subject population is. It is people unlike your brother. It is people who don't know how to try at all. And a fraction of them have almost no self-belief. They're really walking into the gym defeated. And they're like, oh, these weights are so scary. I'm just going to try to survive the process and not really open up my swag. You tell them they're taking steroids and like, look, you can't lose. You're immortal. Like, you're just going to get super strong. Then they're like, oh, all right. Well, here we go. It's imagine, you know, you some nerd at an 80s party standing in the corner knowing he can't dance and there's a good beat on and he's like, nah, I can't do this. He's, you know, doesn't try. And his friends drag him on the floor and he'll bop a couple moves and he sort of scurries back. But if you tell him, like, look, we just did like this mnemonic thing upload into your brain and now you can fucking dance. So if you feel a rhythm, just hit it, do your shit. Like, anytime anyone sort of feels a rhythm and flows, they're going to be a better dancer than if they're doubting themselves. And then all of a sudden he's like, oh my God, I can dance. And then he can dance. But if you give someone who's a trained dancer some kind of magic pill that says this is going to make you better at dancing, 5 minutes into the dancing, you're like, I feel the same. I know how I feel. I know my body well. There's no magic dancing. This is stupid. Or like, yeah, I mean, maybe I feel something. But since they were trying so hard before, you know, the maximum ability to try hard is they're at least very close. And then the trade-off is the other way. Here's the thing. In a few sessions, it can make a big difference. In a few months even. The real thing is, what about when you get tired and accumulate fatigue? Like, if someone tells you you're on steroids, you're apt to go harder in the gym. If you do that for 2 or 3 months at a time, you could hit a big ass wall that you wouldn't hit before because you were actually training with more reps in the tank. Does that mean that you're getting worse gains? No, but you just need a deload earlier. And some people don't. And then they're like, well, I'm steroids, who cares? And then they spend another month really just losing thighs or staying in place because they're like, I can't lose. I have to keep going. I don't need breaks. And that's false. So the placebo effect is neat. And it does show up with people who are amenable to being convinced more that they can try harder and really open up their abilities. But if you're already opening up your abilities, man, you know, there's not a lot to gain there. And to most people who are already training hard, they won't get a lot out of a placebo. I'll tell you this, another thing, the placebo stuff really expanded to more advanced people. When people buy beta-alanine or when they buy leucine or when they buy like some other 50 trillion type of supplement, but they get a placebo effect with all these. That's why they buy them damn near.
Right.
But everyone who's been lifting for a long time and buying these stupid supplements knows that you feel a placebo effect, and then nothing happens, and you're really upset. And then if you ever start actual steroids, you can even not believe in them. You can say, ah, these don't work. I think they're fake. And, you know, 6 injections later, you hit like 30 PRs, and you're like, oh, it actually isn't up to me whether or not these work. And you've seen some of the studies that show like you gain as much from steroids in the first few months of using them as you do from lifting. Like it just doubles your gains. This had got to be a thing. So I totally hear you. The skepticism on the placebo effect is a big thing. And here's my biggest thing. If we're taking this out of training, a lot of people will read studies like that and they'll conclude, just do what you feel is good for you. Do what you prefer. And even if that means a little placebo effect, that's okay because it'll get you gains. Well, it might get you short-term gains. But what's going to happen when long-term you're not getting the gains you want? What's going to happen when you realize that, oh, wait, is this the placebo effect? This thing isn't actually working that I'm telling myself is working. I've been lying to myself. And if you can't lie to yourself all that well, which is usually a very good character trait, your gains are at least going to stop or recede, or it's going to be like, oh, back to square one. So my personal philosophy is not to get too carried away with that kind of stuff. My personal philosophy is to think a little bit ahead down the tracks to say, okay, look, you know, can we use some placebo short-term gains now? Yeah, probably, especially if you're not trying all that hard. What we want to do is instill the right kind of values, the respect for progression, a respect for the slowness of progression, a respect for technique of trying a little bit harder and a little bit harder and a little bit harder. If we can instill those values, you'll grow for years and you'll never have to lie to yourself. As for me, if you have to lie to yourself, it had better be a damn good reason for it, because there's a lot of downsides. Your perception of the way the world works could be illusory, and you don't know which way is up and down. Here's another consideration. You start this new routine. It's just a sets of 5 versus sets of 4 like you used to do. You also start some new exercises, and your placebo effect is it's a sets of 5. That's what's going on. What do you learn from that, let's say, macro cycle where you got good gains? do you learn that sets of five really are that much better than sets of four? Or is it the new exercises you were trying? Well, if you're very attached to experiencing this placebo effect on sets of five, you may falsely attribute that this was the thing that get you better gains. The reality was, actually, you did some novel exercises that fit your muscles better and your body better, and then they're actually the ones that are causing all these gains. So because you were so like into this placebo effect, like, ah, that's what did it, you could be missing what actually did it. And then that's okay, but then you don't learn anything. And then 3 years later, when you have to bring up your gains, you have to bring up your legs, you could be in a position to say, I'll just do five again. Sets of five worked real well last time. But in reality, you should be doing hack squats and leg presses again, because that's what truly worked, but you didn't care because you were like, placebo effect. A quick analogy is like, you could take some kind of drug, let's say weed or something. It actually turns out it's not your drug. But when you took weed, like one time, you were around like all of your best friends and the vibe of the party was just amazing. And you could be like, oh my God, I love weed. And then the next time you take weed, it's not, you're just by yourself and watching TV and you're like, I don't feel great. Well, it turns out it wasn't the weed that was making you feel good last time. It was like being around friends that you loved. You would kind of want to figure out which one it was if you're going to like invest in using weed all the time or investing in a certain kind of training. And then to answer one of your earlier questions about the variation thing, the variation has been demonstrated in studies to have its own benefits. And there's a couple of ways in which it happens. Anytime you train a muscle group through one exercise, let's say squats, generally, it activates most of the muscle group. Like your quads are largely active. That doesn't mean completely. If you switch to hack squats or leg presses, the parts of your quads that are more active actually increase. And we also know that muscles maintain their size way easier than gaining new size. Mm-hmm. If you do squats for 3 months, then leg presses for 3 months, then a hack squat for 3 months, every novel thing that they do grows muscle in that new area. But every non-novel thing that carries over keeps the muscle from the new areas. Like if you got the front of your quads or the bottom of your quads are really hard with hack squats, the top of your quads that you get with high bar squats or more so won't go anywhere because the hack squat is good enough to maintain them. It's just not good enough to grow them. It grows another part. So you grow one part of the muscle with one exercise, maintain the other part, then you go to the other, then you go to the other, then you go to the other. And then that stepwise fashion, you can make better gains than just using everything all at the same time. The problem with using everything all at the same time is you can experience staleness. Like someone's like, nah, man, squat's the best thing for your legs. Like, right. But my knees hurt and my hips hurt, but they don't hurt on the leg press. Can I do leg press? Like, nah, man, just stick to squats. And I've literally seen people give this advice, like, don't worry about variation. Like, okay, but if squats are pretty stale for me now, and I know that I could get at least as good of gains on the leg press and in those other parts that the squats didn't hit, better gains for a while, keeping all my gains from squat, what is there not to like about that situation? And you mentioned that, yeah, your strength, your neural gains are power or your strength. So what I would say to that is just understand underlying why variation is good, strategic variation, sticking to the variants for as long as you need to until they become stale. That's good. But remember that the strength you gain from it isn't anything to get too excited about because it's mostly neurological. So you'd have to be some kind of idiot to be like, oh man, I switched leg press and my leg press went up by 100 pounds. No shit. You're practicing leg presses now.
Right.
But to your point, you said some of the times you experience variation, you experience this neural strength gain, but it doesn't reflect in physique later. That is to say there are better and worse variants. Like for example, if someone built their legs using high bar squats, but now you're like, ooh, try leg extension, stop squatting. The variant is going to seem like you're gaining a lot of strength in leg extension. But because in my view, for most people, leg strength or their leg extension is categorically less stimulative than the squat to the quads and all the other muscles of the thigh, you're actually going to get worse results. So you'd be like, man, I switched to leg press or leg extension only 3 months ago and my quads are either the same or smaller, I'd be honest, but it's been cool to get away and do something different. You wouldn't push that logic further and say, well, you know, Bosu ball squats are next because they're really different. Mm-hmm. But yeah, we want variation for its benefits, but we want variation to be constrained within this box of exercises that still work really well for hypertrophy.
Joel Seedman and Doug Brignoli in those examples.
Brignoli. Is that how you say it? It's not Brignol, it's Brignoli?
It is Brignol. Yeah.
Brignol. Okay. I just want to make sure as I call him Brignol for like 45 minutes straight on one of my YouTube videos. I
would
Yeah. You know, like, so I'm not sure what it is as we, I'll be on your podcast in this character. I'll be completely frank or more frank than I usually am for PR purposes. Two thoughts on those two gentlemen or more specifically their ideas. Doug Brignol seems to be honestly forthright in what he thinks he's doing. I just think there's a bit of a misconstrual of physics and biomechanics and wild oversimplification of some things. Joel Seedman is, you know, have you seen my Mark Bell, the quote unquote debate with him by any chance?
I saw your video after it. Like I saw that one in the Doug video.
Yeah. It's not really clear to me what Joel Seedman actually thinks. A part of me thinks he's doing all this for marketing hype. I'm not so sure what he believes. He explicitly said he posts mostly hype videos because that's what gets the clicks. He literally said that. Mm-hmm. So the back of my head is like, if he's that focused on hype, how focused is he on actually deriving the best long-term results? I literally don't know. The answer could be very focused. Well, the answer could be he just doesn't care. And when somebody's that facade oriented, which is okay. It's a fine way to do. Like I go on public like this. Some people would say that's stupid. I need even more facade oriented. When someone's so facade oriented, you know, like somebody like Eric Helms, like, you know, what Eric says is pretty much what he believes in most cases. Often, quote unquote, to a fault, he could appear quite curt and rude in certain discussions, but like, I just think that's wrong. It's a super awesome character trait though, because it's like, oh, you see what you get. With Joel Seedman, you know, Dave, are you going to say you see what you get with Joel Seedman? Maybe he really is that person, but maybe not. So I actually have no idea. And I wouldn't, you know, Doug Brignall has been good about pretty explicitly outlining what he thinks and what he doesn't. Joel Seedman, not so much. It's very confusing to see what he actually thinks. You know what I mean? What do you think about all that stuff?
Well, and actually another thing I did after watching your video on Joel, I did go back and watch the original debate. So I actually had Doug on a podcast maybe 2 months ago. He was very nice to me. I got the sense at least that he was genuine. And he was open to the, like, intellectual discussion. I agree with you. I personally do believe he oversimplifies things, and basically I agreed with almost all the points that you made in your video.
Super. Thank you.
With Joel, I don't know, when you're basically saying, hey, well, that's not really how I train, but it gets the views. I don't know the guy at all, but it's just kind of like, you're basically just saying like, that's not, you're representing something that's not accurate. Yeah. So I don't know.
It's like one of those spy movies, Dave. You ever see like, it's like an agent, but then they're a double agent, but then they're a triple agent. And towards the end of the movie, you're like, I don't care what happens next because I'm already willing to believe everything and nothing is true. Yeah. You know, it's like movies with like too much magic with too few rules for the magic. Like when the main characters dies and later they just bring them back and you're like, oh, it's death is not something we have to be afraid of in this plot. Yeah. Why am I even paying attention? It's all noise. Right. So yeah. And hopefully, I don't know, like, I think I'd like to have a positive opinion of many people. And I think maybe if Joel can get people a bit excited about training and maybe they start doing his exercises and they think, oh, some of these are nice, but some maybe not great. Then they go down a rabbit hole further of seeking out people that are a bit more on the evidence-based and getting results side. And then their entry point being Joel, maybe they can be exposed to a great thing afterwards, which is why I think, you know, I have had some people say to me, oh, you know, I think he offers some benefits and what do you think of XYZ? I think it's important in discussions like that as representatives of the evidence-based community say, hey, I think the stuff that you're saying that you really liked is good stuff and you should keep doing it. Joel Seedman is kind of, I mean, maybe he's evil. It's unlikely. There's unlikely to be some kind of evil guy that's wrong about everything. You know, I think there's some stuff in there that's good. And then you sort of gently sort of welcome people into the fold. Yeah, this kind of stuff is great. But have you tried high bar squats with a really solid floor and, right, and a really sturdy bar? And they go, well, I'll try that. And they're like, oh, you know, my quads really just got annihilated from that. Where can I read more about this stable training that you're doing? here are some links. And all of a sudden, 3 months later, they're a convert. Where if you tell people like Joel Seedman's stupid, he's a clown, it's fun. And those things may be true to some extent, true about all of us to some extent. But then if we do too much of that, maybe we alienate some of the folks that are from his camp. And then it becomes a battle. It's evidence-based versus Joel Seedman. And he's evil and we're good. And all the people that like him are evil. Most of the people like him are just good people, like anyone. And if we say, hey, this stuff looks cool, I like it, but come try this. And then they try it. And they're like, actually, this works better. They may not even say anything for a while. You know, I don't know if you've ever gone through this, but I've had my mind changed a couple of times. In a big way, and usually I don't admit it on the spot. I just think about it for a while. And I'm like, yeah, I was wrong about that for years. Okay, I'm just going to shut up about it. And then 3 months later, I start saying, hey, this is a thing that I think is true. And they're like, well, you didn't used to. And I'm like, that's true. I changed my mind. It takes a while. So I think it's good to kind of welcome people in and say, yeah, maybe some of the stuff has some value, but come see if our stuff has value too.
Yeah, I think the quote is, a man convinced against his will is of the same opinion still, right? So it's...
Damn, that's a good quote.
Yeah.
Yeah, I have to look up and he's see not really like convinced.
So I know we're coming up on an hour. I just wanted to touch on something you said about the placebo. So one is, your reasons are exactly what I've said before. And I agree, where it's like, you know what? The person who just has no self-belief, they could totally be placeboed. Or even I thought that before with like visualization. Like there's some really impressive studies on visualization. Mm-hmm. And my opinion on that is like, I at one point I remember I took an entire summer and was like visualizing my workouts. But the thing was, like I was already doing everything, at least in my opinion, as well as possible. And so
pretty
it's like,
close.
Right. So it's like the visualization isn't motivating me more because I already said I'm going to do it like 100%. Right. And same thing with like a skill, like maybe Olympic lifting, because that's more of a skill component, but there's studies on darts, on basketball, things like that. Mm-hmm. So yes, you're visualizing.
That's just more practice.
Exactly. But for me, it's like, okay, I bench press for the last 10 years, visualizing.
Pretty well practiced.
Right. So, but these studies, I remember seeing that they were on advanced lifters. The one was like, maybe. I thought like 300, 400 pound bench is like very, I mean, if we're thinking of the same study, there was one that was like in any gym would be impressive lifters. I thought they were from like a national team or something.
Sure. Visualization works. And sometimes it works for short.
I'm talking about the steroid study though. The placebo
steroid. Oh, steroid study.
Yeah. Yeah, I thought those were in like advanced lifters.
Okay. Here's another question. Has that study been replicated a few times? Because if the answer is no, then aberrant research is aberrant research. Yeah. Another thing is, can they get a mesocycle's worth of progress that's better? Yeah. So at one point, there's a pretty famous study by Dr. Mike Stone, who used to be a supervisor of mine. And he did it at the U.S. Olympic Training Center in Colorado Springs. They had enormous, unbelievable if they were able to do the study at all. They took everyone's training volume, pretty much every lifter, and multiplied it by 1.5. They were trying to see where the functional overreaching border really existed. They were kind of looking for MRV without saying as much, right? And what they realized is they were expecting the following. They thought people were pretty hard already, close to MRV, as you could say, as I would say. And then it was 1.5 times would first lead to maybe a functional overreaching, but actually maybe it would first lead to a deficit when they got really fatigued. And then they're planning to pull back on it and then launch a functional overreach, right? That was the plan, is that they would get tired and then we would let them rest a bit and then they would get really good. They never got tired. Dave, the study is publicly available. Like, I'll try to find it for you after this, but they just got better. They just got better and stayed better with 1.5 times more. And you're like, everyone was under training on average, right? So when you have guys that are on a national team, that doesn't preclude them from not training as hard as they think they could be. Just remember, the number one reason people are on national teams isn't that they try harder than everyone else. The number one reason is their genetics are amazing. And if you have people with amazing genetics, almost any coach at any level will tell you, you still have to get a lot out of the athlete.
Yeah.
Because the best athletes are usually genetically gifted. They're not the ones on average that are the most up here gifted of like, I try really hard. I've seen tons of fucking Star Trek nerds bury themselves with volume and effort like no pro bodybuilder ever could. They just don't have the genetics for the body.
Yeah. You and Menno talked about those guys, that on Steve.
Yeah, Menno.
Like, almost like an inverse correlation between.
For sure. Menno was especially... he put his foot down on that, and I do agree with him. It's not something I say often, because it's a bit, sounds insulting to people with good genetics physically, but the reality is that usually just kind of your average person with just really good genetics, and they do bodybuilding is fun, and they're good at it, or powerlifting in this case, and if you really push them and say, you're on steroids now, you're the shit, it can work for a lot of them. Yeah, but for the gritty, hard-nosed, nerd, evidence-based people that have serious psychological problems and they're in the gym trying as hard as possible, me, you, Steve, everyone, mostly kidding, only half. But like all of us, like I've seen Eric Helms train in real life, and like what he calls 2RIR, for me, I would quit like 3 reps before that. He's really trying. I just think you tell Eric he's on steroids, anything's going to happen because he's already maxing it out. Mm-hmm. But the Norwegian powerlifting team or whatever, but yeah, there's plenty of people on the team, at least statistically enough of them, that haven't been trying as hard as they could or haven't been have as much self-belief that when you tell them they're on steroids, they raise the average enough to, on average for the whole team. That you will find almost certainly individuals in that study, if you request raw data or if they publish the individual results with a variance, you'll find people for whom thinking they're on steroids either did nothing or they got weaker during the study. So remember, the average got stronger. But for some people, it doesn't seem to work, probably in part due to some of the reasons you and I suspect. Like if you're already grinding and really have a lot of self-belief, taking quote-unquote steroids may just be the same and nothing changes.
Yeah, I was going to say, if you just take an hour to scour the bodybuilding forums, you'll see no shortage of people who post like, you know, X drug isn't working. You know, it's like, well, where's the placebo there? You're actually taking something and you're apparently not seeing results. So you see that too.
100%. That's a real disaster. You start steroids and all, you just get flu-like symptoms and no gains. Like, it's disastrous. And another way of phrasing it as a gift, because then you cannot buck with all this crazy stuff that's bad for your brain and your body and everything.
Yeah.
You just be like a normal person for the love of God.
Right. All right, man. Well, as always, anytime I've talked to you, I end up with more topics I want to discuss than I started with, but maybe we'll get you back on in 2022.
That sounds great. I would love to be a guest again. This is always a pleasure. Always excellent questions, by the way. So.
And where can people find more of your stuff, man?
Well, you know, I used to say Instagram, but I got banned from that shit.
Oh, yeah. What happened, if I can ask?
Yeah, I don't know. So my Instagram disappeared, and then there was some investigative work followed, and it turns out it was some kind of post from June 5th, 2021, that this review came up in, like, October. It wasn't the trans post.
Yeah.
Almost certainly it wasn't the recent nudity post. It was just that post from back then, but I had already had so many knocks on my account from earlier warnings, which, by the way, were also never adjudicated. They'll tell you, like, this is bad, don't do it again. And they're like, would you like to, you know, get, like, some resolution? And I'm like, every time, I'm like, yes, I don't think what I'm doing is bad. And they never get back to you, and then you don't ever see. People say, like, if you have enough dings in your account, it begs the question of, where do I see how many dings I have on my account? Well, there's nowhere to see that. It doesn't exist. So I don't know if I'm, like, 5 out of 10 or 9 out of 10. And I guess I was a 9. And then that last post from June 5th, it said this made the Instagram community feel unsafe. I've done a lot of things on Instagram. I don't think I've ever questioned or put safety at risk for anything.
Yeah, right.
So that was it. And then they said there's some investigation, and they're like, ooh, looks like your account wasn't even banned. It was actually outright deleted, which I got a personal. It was really sad because I think I lost like 7 years of pictures of intimate pictures of my life, which is kind of like, I can sort of get them off of backup phones and stuff, but it's kind of sad. Like if I ever meet someone on a plane who works for Instagram, I'll be like, oh, yeah, like, you guys have a bunch of my pictures, or you deleted them, and I don't even remember my fucking life. But
but
in any case, yes.
Go ahead.
It's not my platform. It's theirs. The pictures don't belong to me. They belong to them. If you read the fine print, that's what it says. So I'm no beef with them. Dr. Mike Isretel, spelled exactly like that, no spaces or whatever. It's my new Instagram. It's already up to 16,000 followers, so we're not doing too bad. I have some things in the works right now to see if I get my old account back. 5% chance that I do, 95% that I don't. But as soon as I get whatever account is stable, I'm going to put up a new YouTube video to tell people, hey, come follow me in this account, and we'll get up to plenty of followers again. So Dr. Mike Isretel, good place to follow me on Instagram. But honestly, for folks listening, and I don't even use Instagram as my primary social media anymore, YouTube, man, come follow us on YouTube. Renaissance Periodization, or just type in my last name to YouTube. Find our channel. We produce 4 or 5 high in-depth quality content videos, content, learning every week. And we will for perpetuity, as long as my brain doesn't break. So if you want to learn stuff, we got all kinds of series. Sorry to use your podcast as a platform for promoting myself, but we have tons of series that I think people who listen to this podcast would be into. I'm not the biggest fan in the world of only ever doing one-off YouTube videos. Like, here's the topic, here's the video, that's it. And some topics are complex and interrelated. For example, we have a series just recorded that'll be out in a few months, Busting Through Strength Plateaus. And you can think, like, busting through strength plateaus, it's not just one 30-minute video. There's a lot of methods and a lot of complexity and a lot of analysis of what exactly is causing these plateaus. Mm-hmm. That video series is going to be like 8 or 12 videos. Like, if you get, and we already have tons of videos, series recorded. If you really want an in-depth dive, as like, truly learn shit, come to the RP YouTube channel, Renaissance Periodization, Mike Isretel. Go through a bunch of that stuff. I promise you'll love it. If you don't love it, my promise is null and void, and I just lied to you. But in any case, I think it's for some people, a lot of people have said it's a welcome reprieve from the other end of fitness YouTube, which is mostly like chatterbox gossip and not a whole lot of learning. You know, this is like, yeah, we have our fun and I do my stupid jokes, but it's mostly like a lot of learning. So if you're a real nerd, come to us, we'll take care of you.
Awesome. Yeah, I have noticed you guys have been doing more and more on YouTube. I think it's been awesome. So I'll
thank you so much.
And everything below.